Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. She deserves more. Women in the low-wage workforce during the pandemic are suffering immeasurably. A look at gender disparity and poverty for low-income women.
That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages, lifted over mud puddles, and have the best place everywhere. Ain't no man ever lifted me into carriages or helped me over mud puddles.
That was Ann Feeney. Ain't I a Woman?
We're joined by Shally Gupta-Barnes, Policy Director at the Caro Center. She coordinated and edited The Souls of Poor Folk, Auditing America Report for the Poor People's Campaign.
Now, she deserves more. Women in the low-wage workforce during the pandemic. Shally Gupta-Barnes, thanks for joining us. Shally, women are disproportionately represented among the low-wage workforce and have been hit especially hard during the COVID-19 crisis. Amplify on that for us.
Just to give you a sense of how badly women have been hit through this pandemic recession is December 2020. The economy lost 140,000 jobs. And if you look at those numbers deeper, men gained 16,000 jobs and women lost 156,000. That means women accounted for all of the jobs that were lost in December. This phenomenon is particularly hitting women of color, Black and Latina women, hardest. And it's partially because they're in the hardest hit sectors of the economy right now: childcare, healthcare, hospitality, education, retail. And these were the sectors that are both hit with the pandemic, but also low wage. So they don't have the kinds of income guarantees or other job protections that exist in other more secure occupations, such as paid sick leave, family leave, healthcare, all of the things we need right now. So on top of a jobs crisis, this is really a health crisis, and women, and disproportionately women of color, are at the very center of it.
And if I can just ask if you could break that down a little further insofar as what about immigrant women and women who are documented and those who are undocumented as immigrants? Is there an additional statistic or understanding of how they're being hit within that already terrible number that you just related to us of 140,000 job loss?
Yeah, so just to step back for 1 second, according to the National Women's Law Center, women held about two-thirds of the jobs in the 40 lowest-paying jobs in the country. And women of color were overrepresented in terms of their proportion of the workforce. So, you know, white women account for about one-third of that low-wage workforce. Latinas account for 16%, which is almost twice as much as their share in the workforce as a whole. Black women account for almost 1.5 times or 10% of that workforce. And so you can just see that the systemic racism that's also at play here. And we know that immigrant women and undocumented immigrant women will be, you know, among some of the most dangerous frontline work at this time, whether it's in the food processing sectors, whether it's in the, you know, service sectors, whether it's in, you know, agricultural and these sectors of the economy. This is, you know, where there are virtually no protections, where wages are much lower than even, you know, what the federal minimum wage is at $7.25. And so the vulnerability that women are facing, that immigrant women are facing, that undocumented immigrant women are facing is really an untold story of this pandemic. And you know, just to say that, and maybe this is something we can talk about for a minute, that this didn't start with this pandemic. It started, I would say, at least, you know, more than a decade ago after the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. You know, what happened basically, so first of all, you know, the Great Recession just wiped out almost 2 million middle-income jobs in the country. And it was an interesting time after that because for a while, women and men had closer to gender parity in the labor force. But that wasn't because women were gaining jobs. It's because men were losing jobs. And that's not the kind of parity we want. But over that decade, the jobs that returned were predominantly low-wage jobs. So the middle-income jobs were more or less wiped out. They were replaced by low-wage jobs that were more precarious. They didn't have health care. They didn't have any benefits. They were temporary or part-time. And women and people of color were disproportionately moved into those sectors over the past decade. And the other thing to note alongside that is, you know, the last time the minimum wage was raised was 2009. During that Great Recession, and it was raised to $7.25 an hour. It hasn't been raised since. And so we're seeing this static wage that was implemented during one of the worst economic crises of this country that hasn't changed since then, and who's been moved into that spot are women and people of color disproportionately. And so that, I would say, you know, is some of the basis upon which this current economic crisis is hitting, again, women and women of color particularly so hard, who've been working in these jobs for a decade, whose savings have been run down, whose, you know, mounting bills, the cost of living are going up, the cost of health care, housing, utilities have all gone up faster than this expansion of low-wage work. And, you know, there isn't a county in the country where you can afford a two-bedroom apartment working full-time at $7.25 an hour. And so in many places, you need at least twice that. So these are long-term trends that brought us to this moment, and the pandemic just kind of brought all of that to the, you know, to the devastating point where we are now.
Shelley, to what extent does the fact that many of these jobs that you're talking about not lend itself to in-home work, so people have to actually leave their homes to do the work and can't do work from home as many of the other workers can?
You know, this is what we're hearing from childcare workers, from food sector workers, from workers across the low-wage economy, that while everyone else, while many other workers are able to stay at home, stay safe, protect themselves the best way possible, they still, even though they were described as essential workers, they were placed in this position of having to work outside of the home. And the economy was kind of maintained on their backs, to be honest. They were termed as essential, but they've been treated as if they're expendable. You know, many of them were working in places that didn't have protective equipment, that didn't have OSHA standards, that didn't have, again, all of these other protections in place, and working for poverty wages. Again, it's the compounded effect of not being able to stay at home when the unemployment payments were being made and were keeping families afloat. That provided some security to allow certain people to stay at home, certain of these essential and frontline workers to stay at home. But even then, they were often in this position of having to decide between taking the unemployment insurance or losing the opportunity for work once that insurance expired. And so we know that there are lots of cases of low-wage workers who were forced back into work because they didn't want to lose, you know, they were back into work too early under unsafe conditions because their states opened too quickly.
Shally, I wonder if you can also give us a sense of the nature of the work that these women do and the essentiality of the jobs, which are so often taken for granted. What positions do they have within the workforce? What are the jobs?
We're talking about the people who are stocking food and stocking the shelves at the places, at the big box stores, at the places we go to buy the vital food and resources we need to feed and care for our families. And about the folks who are still in our long-term care, taking care of our elders. We're talking about the folks taking care of our children. We're talking about the folks who are really every day, you know, providing critical services for millions and millions of households across the country. They're the jobs that they haven't been paid, you know, they're minimum wage and low wage jobs because the economy has never valued their work. And now in this moment, when everyone else has been shut down, everyone else is being able to stay at home and work at home, none of their jobs are online. None of these jobs can be transitioned to being online. And so they are at the fore, they are in some of the wealthiest corporations, working for some of the wealthiest corporations, which have relied on low-wage jobs, on tips, and on federal welfare programs to keep the low-wage workforce going. So it's really the exploitation facing these women, the exploitation facing the broader sectors and numbers, the millions of low-wage workers out there is something that we don't hear about enough. And this is why, you know, the work of the 5-15 and a union and the work of low-wage workers like Cherie Allen and Ishani Gaston and Sarah Farrington and so many more who are leading the way, showing us the conditions they're working in and how that has to be changed, not only what is necessary, but also what is possible, we really all have to follow their lead in this.
Well, you mentioned one woman in particular, Cherie Allen, who has been, we know, very active in the fight for 15, et cetera. But put that human face on. Give us a sense of what women like Cherie actually specifically face from this desperate, disproportionate situation that has been fallen women during this recession, during this pandemic period.
So, you know, Cherie was a child care worker, and she got laid off at the start of the pandemic. And as a child care worker, she was only making $5 an hour. And she got laid off at the start of the pandemic, and she was told because they didn't need her anymore because of the virus. You know, as she says, their work has always been undervalued and underpaid, and their rights have been unprotected. So even as a child care worker, someone who's taking care of children, the future of our economy, the future of the society, she never had full benefits. She never had a union. And getting laid off was extremely difficult for her. Her bills never stopped coming in just because she lost her job. She never had any kind of insurance or paid sick days to begin with. And so then she's in this situation of having to cobble together whatever opportunity she can to make ends meet or at least to have something coming in so she can figure out which bill to pay and which bill to not pay. She would much rather be taking care of children. That's what the work she's been doing. But she's in this position of having to take whatever work is available. And I could also tell you about some other workers with the Fight for 15, like Sarah, who's the mom of 6 children. Her husband has a medical condition. And she was a Waffle House worker working on tips, earning less than $5 an hour, earning $2 or $3 an hour. And she was laid off during this pandemic. And so you can imagine what is possible to save or spend when you're earning so little. And then what is possible then when that is taken away and there are no social supports to rely on? And these two women are part of this massive growing call for not only fair wages and $15 an hour, but the right to build power together in unions and the right to then have health care as low-wage workers and all of these other rights, because we know that none of this stands on its own. You know, to have $15 an hour, that's still not going to be enough to meet everything you need, where everybody deserves health care. Everybody deserves to have quality public schools for our children and safe and reliable transportation and clean air. All of this has to be taken together. But it begins when these workers and other people like them start to build power together and to make these claims that this isn't a question of left or right, it's a question of right or wrong. And what Cherie and Sarah and all these other people have been facing has been wrong. And they're loudly saying this, and it's time that finally we're listening. Finally, this society and this economy and our lawmakers are finally listening.
Shelley, many of these workers like Sherry are considered to be independent contractors. How does that complicate things, both in terms of getting benefits and also joining unions?
As an independent contractor, you know, not only are they subject to higher tax rates, but they don't have the rights of kind of employees of the employer. And so if they had that employee-employer relationship, then the employer would be responsible for more of those protections, for more accountability towards the condition of their employees. There's a fiduciary relationship in there. That doesn't exist with independent contractors. They're responsible. They are not, the employer is not accountable to them for any of those protections that are otherwise given to employees. And so the status of independent workers, especially for gig economy workers, for independent contractors, for, you know, people who are in that position, is incredibly difficult. We've seen that, you know, across the board in Uber drivers, Lyft drivers, other, you know, independent contractor relationships. And this is actually on the ballot in California, but it was voted down in part because those big corporations, you know, lobbied to and, you know, spent a lot of money to have that independent contractor status maintained versus being held accountable and responsible to the people who are actually making those corporations profitable from year to year.
We haven't mentioned Asian and Asian Pacific Islander women.
The percent of the low-wage workforce for Asian American Pacific Islander women account for about 4% of the low-wage workforce, and Indigenous women account for almost twice as much of their share as the overall workforce. They account for almost 1% of the workforce. So they're overrepresented in the low-wage workforce compared to their population more generally.
Unions would solve many of these problems if these workers could join unions, but many of the conditions you're talking about prevents that. Do you want to talk about that?
The unionization rate in the country is something around 10 or 11%. It's very low compared to what it's been historically, but what we've seen, unionized workers have been able to maintain more of their jobs, but also more of the protection through this pandemic than non-unionized workers. Women, again, disproportionately represented in this low-wage workforce, are less protected by the unions that would otherwise be there. And this is why the demand of the Fight for 15 around the wage and the union is so critical. You know, they're also fighting for being able to unionize across sectors, not just this one restaurant's workers against this one restaurant, but let's say, what if all restaurant workers were able to together in a union and exert a pressure through that cross-sectoral organizing on the whole sector of restaurant corporations, on, you know, on the McDonald's and all of that? That would put workers in a fundamentally different position. And so the question how you build power is critical for low-wage workers. And therefore, this question of unionizing, this question of cross-sectoral unionizing has been innovative and creative and necessary solutions coming out of low-wage worker organizing in the past few years.
Shelley Gupta Barnes very often single-heads household women, and how they live or are not able to really live in this society is they don't have a society that provides child care expenses for them. And they, no matter whether or not there was $15 an hour, which is really passé in order to be able to live in this society, the issue of 80% at least of one's income going to rent, how do we look at those issues to address the astronomical costs of rent, of health care, that put women in such a detrimental situation in a low-wage job?
At the center of your question is, how do we make sure that everyone can not only survive in this country but thrive, not only meet our needs but live decent lives? Everyone should be able to have a house that has running water, that has heat and electricity, and increasingly, you know, Wi-Fi and internet services and communications. How do we address that? The way that we measure and think about poverty in this country has not been updated, in fact, for over 50 years. the official poverty line, a family of four needs about, you know, $25,000-$26,000 to not be considered poor. A family of four earning $30,000 a year is living above the poverty line. So officially, they're not counted as poor. But we all know that as the cost of housing, the cost of healthcare, the cost of transportation, childcare, all of these things have gone up, $30,000 means that you are not being able to meet all of your needs on a daily basis. You know, we have to reframe the debate around poverty in this country. We have to update the measure of poverty and government programs that are meeting the need at hand and not just kind of maintaining this sub-survival level of poverty in this country. That it's a real issue that we've got to take up in a serious way. And it will open up new conversations about who is poor and what poverty looks like today.
What are the policies that are being presented, and what is the legislation, if any, that's being advocated to deal with this catastrophic situation of women in poverty and low-wage women, in particular, of color?
Early on in President Biden's term and also this new Congress, a commitment to taking these issues very seriously. There's been a series of executive orders calling for equitable, data-driven COVID relief and attention towards immigration and immigrants and the situation that frontline and essential workers are facing, including mandating OSHA standards, including ensuring, you know, equitable distribution of this vaccine and all of these things. There's also, you know, the American Rescue Plan that President Biden is encouraging Congress to implement. It has a lot in there that will make big moves towards meeting some of these immediate problems. The $1,400 stimulus would bring the household stimulus up to $2,000. It would include many mixed status families, not all of them. It would include many mixed status families. It would include bring our unemployment insurance payments back up to $400 a week. There are a lot of things there that are good and necessary. And most recently, we saw the Raise the Wage Act being introduced into Congress, which would bring the federal minimum wage up to $15 an hour in 2025. This would lift 32 million workers, and 59% of the women who are working in low-wage jobs bring their pay up significantly. We need this now, not 5 years down the road. We have to make sure that all workers are included, including tipped workers, young workers, all of that. But I think we're seeing some encouraging actions being taken. We know the pressure points that we have to keep putting on this administration and on Congress to do more. As you mentioned earlier, I'm the policy director of the Kairos Center. I'm also the policy director of the Poor People's Campaign. And we have been pushing for 14 priorities for this 100 days, talking about the creation of real jobs program that would ensure high quality, good paying jobs that have all these protections, you know, and targeting women around childcare, long-term care, the expansion of our public health infrastructure, the expansion and more resources for our schools to ensure that all of our children and families know that our kids are having good quality education that's safe online and offline, and the broad set of priorities that can be implemented sooner than 2025. And all of these have to go together. This includes really thinking about our tax system, redirecting resources away from military spending, from spending on prisons and incarceration, redirecting so many of these resources to the things we need, to the things that Sheree Allen and all these incredible women and their families need. Because there are decades of policies that brought us to this point. We need an utter transformation from the bottom up, from our lawmakers, from the society, to address the issues and center the issues of low-wage workers, of the poor, of women and women of color who are at the very center of this crisis, and make sure that their needs and demands are met. Because when you lift from the bottom, as we say in this campaign, when you lift from the bottom, everybody rises. This is what's going to be, that's going to revive our economy. It's going to bring in an era of, you know, a real unity. And this is what's going to allow us to, you know, build back better than we ever have.
What are the issues in terms of reproductive rights, reproductive health for women that add to their poverty and add to a political, well, there's the reality of a terrifyingly politically reactionary way of dealing with, and it's systemic in the healthcare industry, certainly through the courts, of women's reproductive health? And how much does that have to do, and what needs to be the agenda there?
If we talk about expanding our healthcare system and our public healthcare infrastructure, also thinking about those who are at the very core of the attacks on healthcare. Reproductive rights is critical to secure. The attack on women's health is not limited to any particular state. It is nationwide. And this is a fight that every one of us is invested in. And it's part of what it will mean to have robust, meaningful public healthcare system that secures our fundamental rights. We need to see more united action on from lawmakers and from this administration. And I'm hopeful that as these powerful women continue to come together and speak together as a united force, that they compel that kind of action from all different sectors of the society.
And to keep up with the work of the Caro Center and to contact the center or yourself in terms of what's coming up next, what is your website and what is the way to contact the Caro Center?
You can follow the Caro Center on Twitter and social media at Caro Center, and then our website is CairoCenter.org. And then you can also, of course, follow the Poor People's Campaign at PoorPeople'sCampaign.org, but also we're on social media as at Unite the Poor under Twitter and the Poor People's Campaign on Facebook and Instagram.
Shelley Gupta-Barnes, Policy Director at the Caro Center, thank you for uniting human rights with economic rights. The two must go hand in hand for people to live a full and productive life. Thank you for the work that you do and joining us today.
Thank you both.
To all our listeners, stay strong, stay well, educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people for a better world if possible, and we are the ones to make it so.